prominent theologian recently said that few subjects are as important as the role of women in the church, either in church life, activity, or in church government. But most of the help that women have been given by the Christian community ignores such basic issues as identity and equality. And often it misappropriates and misapplies the biblical terms of submission and authority. And I think that the church is far from exhausted the application of its principles to our problems today as women. And we need to look to the Word further and go deeper. The supreme textbook of humanity is the Word of God. And so now we're going to take the Word and look into it further. And we're going to consider the Word of God inspired and authoritative. We're going to seek truth, not theory. Fact, not fancy. Instruction, not imagination. The trend today is a focus on autonomy. How many of y'all have read the book Passages? Is anybody? That's an interesting book, isn't it? One thing that I got out of that there was a focus on autonomy. And the whole idea was is that if you're not independent, you won't be successful. And you must at all risk learn to stand alone. And if you depend on anyone, that's a sure road to lack of fulfillment. C.S. Lewis warned of the dangers of chronological snobbery, and that is the tendency to accept whatever theory is currently in vogue as necessarily valid. You know, we just let the thinking of the culture get into our minds and our hearts, and there's great danger in that. The human view is that whatever my wishes are and whatever my desires are is good. Once a little girl came up to her preacher dad and she said, "Daddy, I do want to do what I do want to do." And isn't that true of all of us? Man, we do want to do what we do want to do. We're self-centered. And yet, if we are self-centered, we will be alienated from the truth. And I know in all of our lives there are little ways in which we are self-centered, and in that area of our life, we'll be alienated from the truth. Isaiah 55, 8 through 9 says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." It's sheer realism to state that life is not fundamentally romantic, but it's basically tragic, and it's in constant need of redemption. And God offers us a quality of life that's based on His integrity and His character and not our own faulty human reasoning. To be God-centered is to opt for truth and the unfolding of reality and abundant living. To be self-centered is to choose counterfeit truth and camouflaged reality, narrowness of life. And we think the opposite, don't we? That if we can fulfill ourselves, that will be abundance. But that's not what will happen. Only Jesus Christ deserves to be at the center of our lives. He should be our first love. And Elaine Stedman has written a beautiful poem about this. Who is your first love? The one who makes you feel really, honestly you, who brings to your life renewal and dimension, beauty and wholeness, who recognizes the uniqueness of your potential and fully respects your humanity. Who is willing to share your joys and distresses and forgive your failures with undaunted acceptance. Whose love holds you captive and yet sets you free. Who is willing to die for you or to live for you, and who evokes the same response from you? Who thus teaches you to love and to be loved? Is anything less than this really love? Is there really anything more than agape himself? Who alone has earned the right to be your first love? And in the light of Christ's great love for us, I would like for us to look at his view of women in the New Testament. Bishop Lightfoot said that to contemporaries, Jesus' treatment of women probably appeared in the light of a social revolution. He treated women as capable persons in their own right. He taught them. In that day and time, rabbis didn't teach women, you only taught men. But he taught women, and he was concerned for their spiritual education and for their welfare. And when he said that whoever does the will of God is my brother and my sister and my mother, he showed that sex constitutes no barrier to intimacy with him. And when he said that if somebody were to choose, when he said that he might set a mother against the daughter, he was showing that a woman might take an independent line in religion. He commended women for their active faith as the woman who touched his garment and was healed. And he commended women for sacrificial giving as the widow who gave sacrificially. And Mary anointed his feet with a costly perfume. And he held her up as an example to men. And it was a woman who led the way and said that there is no tribute that is too rich to give Christ. And he held them up as examples to men. His teaching on divorce elevated women probably in a way that we in the 20th century cannot begin to grasp. He led his hearers back to the institution of marriage in Genesis, and he taught that marriage is indissoluble in God's sight. And this elevated the woman to the position of equal partner, and this was a new thing. And so as regards spiritual privilege, there can be no doubt that Jesus considered the two sexes equal. And baptism is another example of this. Baptism is the initiatory rite into Christianity, and both man and woman can partake of that rite. But in Judaism, the initiatory rite was circumcision, and only a man could partake of that. So baptism vividly illustrates the principle that there is no male and female, that all are one in Christ Jesus. And there are no second-class citizens in the kingdom of heaven or in the church. We all have mutual access to the Holy Spirit and to the spiritual gifts. We are joint heirs to every spiritual resource. And we're all equally necessary parts of the body. And so just to summarize this section, Jesus' view of women was that we are equal in spiritual privilege. Sex is no barrier to intimacy with him, and Jesus held up women as examples to men. And then his teaching on divorce and then the rite of baptism elevated the status of women in a new way. But you want that. I will wait. Okay. I'll give you the but in a minute. The thing that must be remembered is that equality and spiritual privilege does not mean uniformity of practice or the obliteration of all the differences between the sexes. And that's what we need to remember. Are you through with that? I'll put it back up in just a second. I want to get this point across. Equality in value does not imply sameness. And this is really key. Equality in value does not imply sameness. Now, women played a very important role in the expansion of the church. But to say that they played a leadership role is another matter. Jesus made a very definite distinction between men and women. And Jesus ministered to the men, but the women ministered to Jesus. And it is interesting that any time it is said in the Bible that women ministered or that someone ministered to Jesus, it was either women or angels. They served him, and that is the Greek word diakoneo, and it means they supplied the necessities of life for Jesus. Some examples of this are Peter's mother-in-law, who, haven't you always been just awed at the fact that she was really sick and Jesus came and healed her? And she immediately got up and began to minister to Jesus to supply the necessities of life that he needed. And another example is the band of women that followed Jesus and the disciples around, and they ministered to him with their substance. Another example is Martha, and she was always having Jesus in her home and serving him. I'll put this back up if you want to finish doing that. Jesus appeared to women first after he rose from the dead. But have you ever thought about the fact that probably the reason he appeared to them first was that they were being faithful to their womanly duties? They were coming to anoint his body, and God honored that faithfulness to their duties and appeared to them first. And I think that's exciting. It's also very important to note what is not said about women in the Bible and to consider the implications. The incarnation was a man. The 12 disciples were all men. The 70 disciples were all men. The chief missionary activity was done by men. All the books of the New Testament were written by men. And the church leadership were men. The apostolic commission, the Great Commission, was given to men. And even the Lord's Supper was initiated in the presence of men only. And I think that's significant because you would think that at a supper there would be women there serving, but there weren't at that particular time. So, although Jesus granted great freedom to women, he limited their sphere and he glorified their domestic responsibility. He gave the leadership positions to men. And you have that quote in your paper. So we are equal in spiritual privilege, but we are different in function. Jesus granted great freedom to women, but he limited their sphere by glorifying their domestic responsibilities, and he gave the leadership positions to men. Okay, it's time to break for lunch. And let me give you just a few little instructions. We thought that if you would just exchange your lunch. Oh, wait, we've got to do the action first, don't we? Okay, do your reaction papers first, and then I'll give you your instructions. You want to go in? Okay, she was a queen. Good. Good. What else? She was beautiful. Okay. Who were some of the characters in the Book of Esther? Haman. Ahasuerus. Very good, very good. Very good pronunciation. Okay, Mordecai, Haman. Very good. Okay, the Bible tells us that at a certain point in time, the king, King Ahasuerus, was displaying his glory. And he was displaying the splendor of his majesty to the people in his realm. And in his graciousness, he asked the common people to come into his castle. And he set a feast for them, and it was a 7-day feast for the common people. And the Bible tells us that there were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings, and marble columns and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds. Have you ever drunk out of a golden vessel? These common people were drinking out of the king's golden vessels. And the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. Well, at the height of the king's merriment and exultation, he summoned the queen to come to him. And the queen was the high point of his glory because the woman is the glory of the man. But Queen Vashti wasn't concerned for the king's reputation, but she was only concerned that she be able to display her power, and so she refused to come. Well, the king's glory just came crashing around him, and his anger knew no bounds. He called his counselors to him, and they began to discuss the matter. What should they do? Well, his counselors were very wise, and they knew the power of example. And they knew that if the women in the realm discovered what Queen Vashti had done, that they would begin to show contempt for their husbands, and that the result would be chaos in the nation. And so they decided that Queen Vashti was to be stripped of her royal power, and that someone worthier of the king was to be found. And decrees were sent out into the realm that every man, small or great, was to be the head of his household, and that no man was to be deemed worthless. And this was put into immutable law. Well, there was a young maiden in the land. She was a stranger to the land. She was Jewish, and she didn't have any parents. But she had an uncle who was like a father to her and loved her very dearly, and he had spent a lot of time training her. They were Benjamites, and they had a zeal for God and for right. When Esther became a candidate for queen, it was evident that there was something very unusual about her. And she wasn't only unusual in the beauty of her face and her form, but she was also beautiful within. She was unusual within because her meek and quiet spirit that she had learned from submitting to Mordecai's authority shone and made her really special and unusual. Whenever she was supposed to go into the king for the first time, she asked the king's eunuch what she should take with her, and she just did what he advised and just took his authority as vital and good. And then even after she became queen, she submitted to Mordecai's authority when she really didn't have to. And the result of such a spirit was that she found favor with all. And I believe that as soon as she got married, that she began to study her husband. And she studied his pleasures, his bents, his passions, and she began to lay a foundation. And it was a foundation of beauty, responsiveness, and respect. And this foundation was so solid and so extensive that there came a time when he said, "What is your petition, Esther? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. Whatever you ask, I will do." Man was made to be an initiator, and woman was made to be a responder. And we see that Esther, although she was a very, very much a thinking woman, she was also an extraordinarily responsive one. When she heard that Mordecai was dressed in sackcloth and ashes and he was in mourning, the Bible tells us that she writhed in anguish for him in empathy. And at this time, she didn't even know why he was mourning. But she writhed in anguish for Mordecai because she knew that he was very upset. And then when she went to Mordecai and he told her what the problem was, you know, "Your people are in danger." Well, she responded by giving him key information. You know, "If I go into the king, then I may die." But then Mordecai told her, "You have to do it. You know, it may be that you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this." And so just immediately Esther responded and said, "Yes, I will do it." And her response was similar to another godly woman who said, "Behold, the handmaiden of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word." And then when she approached the king, and in a sense she was initiating, but she did it in a responsive way, and she appealed to him with the beauty that he loved. She was dressed in her long, beautiful robes, and she had already prepared a banquet that he knew he would just love. She knew that he would love. because he loved banquets. And then as she began to share her heart with him and her problems, she appealed to his authority, and she would say, if it please the king, and if it seems right to you. So even her initiation was responsive. And then the second time that she went in to talk to him, still she was really sure now that he wanted to please her, but still her weeping and her imploring were laced about with appeals to his authority and honor. What we can learn today from this godly woman of discretion. She had figured out a very intricate plan for winning the favor and the power of her husband. And yet she didn't just pour out everything all at one time. She wove an aura of mystery about herself. And God says that the heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer. And she knew that she needed to inform the king of things that he didn't know, that she couldn't be silent any longer, and she had to be willing to stand alone. But God showed her how to do it with a tremendous amount of discretion. And this is the key word, discretion. Discretion is perception. And it means to taste, to save, to protect, and to heal. But you didn't know it meant that, did you? Isn't that something? It involves intelligence, judgment, reason, understanding, and self-control. And yet, you know, there's an element of freedom in discretion because we can decide how we're going to say things. We can decide if we're going to wield our words rashly or if we're going to use our words in ways that heal. And God says that a woman is really not beautiful at all if she doesn't have discretion. In fact, he says she's ridiculous. How many of you know the verse in Proverbs 11:22? It says, like a ring of gold and a pig's snout, so is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion. And I think, you know, it's kind of funny, but God was serious, I think, when he had Solomon write that. You can be a really beautiful woman, and if you haven't learned discretion, you really have no true beauty. Proverbs 2:11 says, discretion will guard you and understanding will watch over you. And Proverbs 3:21-22, keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and adornment to your neck. And I believe that Esther's life was saved because of her discretion. And this is no small thing. We just really need to learn discretion. And I know that in my life, the Lord has tremendously convicted me that I not just always be pouring out everything I feel to my husband, but that I ponder upon how to answer and think, how to say things and use my words in ways that will heal. Queen Vashti and Zeresh, now I don't know if anybody mentioned Zeresh, but she was the wife of Haman. And both of these ladies are opposites of Esther. Queen Vashti was very beautiful, but she was very rebellious, and she almost brought chaos to the nation, and she forfeited her own power by her rebellion. Zeresh was a woman whose husband was always coming to her for advice, but she counseled him in ways that encouraged him to wickedness and to greed. And so the Bible tells us that after Haman was executed, that all of Haman's worldly goods were given to Mordecai. And, you know, Haman thought he was so great because he was so rich and had all of these neat things. But then all of his goods went to Mordecai. And so the wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. Esther's submissive spirit, her responsiveness, and her discretion caused a downtrodden people to become a people of power. She was a catalyst. Esther was the catalyst behind the scenes, private but powerful. The catalyst. She was a motivational influence, and she had great power. could we say that what our men are reveal what we are? If our husbands do not have helpers that are fit for them, what a difference it will make in our homes, in our children's lives, and in the nation. And if our husbands won't listen to our counsel when it is godly, is it because we're wielding our power wildly, unwisely, and we're not taking time to think and to pray and to be discreet? Have we forfeited our power because we are so frantically seeking a 50-50 relationship that we only know how to initiate but not how to respond? We are just working at learning to be aggressive. And so therefore, we've forfeited our power. We don't know how to respond. Are we seeking self-fulfillment so frantically that we forgot to lay the foundation of ministering to our husbands with our own beauty, which is so priceless to him, and little gifts and food and drink? And those seem so simple, but you know how much they mean to a man. And do we even begin to know the joy of offering these things consistently and self-sacrificially until there comes a time when our husbands say, "What's troubling you? What's your petition? Whatever you ask, I will do." And I think that such freedom in a marriage today is rare, and yet I believe that that's what God meant for it to be like. We have the freedom to decide if we will lose all the power that God gave us to sway the world through our constant initiating and contention, and if we will thus tear down our house and our nation with our own hands, or if we will wield our power joyfully because we allow God to teach us responsiveness and discretion. Perhaps there is one big event in every woman's life that she is training for day by day in little ways. And perhaps those little faithfulnesses will someday culminate in an event, private but key, that will influence peoples and generations for years to come. So that's Esther, tremendous woman of discretion and power. Now let's look down at the next subject, identity. A little boy, a 7-year-old, was asked to write a composition. In fact, one of the teachers that was going to be here today asked him to write this composition. And he was supposed to write one on why he loved his mom, and one on why he loved his dad. And so this is what he wrote. "I love my dad because he helps me set the electric train up. He takes us on bike rides, and he lets me help him. I like my dad." And then he said, "I love my mom because she loves me." Did you get that? "I love my mom because she loves me and buys me things. She makes my lunch. She takes me to places. I think my mom is terrific." I think that gives us a little bit of a sense of the different roles that a man and a woman have, and the different functional perspectives that a man and a woman have give a balanced and sensitive approach to parenthood. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, tells how his main characters are in great danger. The witch has discovered where they are, and she is coming fast on her sleigh to get them and to turn them to stone. And so they are in the beaver's house, and Mother Beaver knows that they need to immediately escape. And so what does she do? She begins to get blankets together, and she makes hot drinks, and she gets food together, you know, and cuts bread. And so they say, "What are you doing?" And she answers, "Oh, just be patient. It'll work out. You'll be so glad later on." Well, sure enough, when they got to a place where they were tired and cold and hungry, they were so glad that she had thought of those things. And a mother is a nurturer and an encourager, and she thinks of those things when a husband and a father doesn't. And as I began to study, even back in the spring, and we began to study this subject, I was excited about the destiny of being a nurturer. Grace Kelly has some challenging comments on this topic. She says, "Work undertaken outside the home can often inhibit our most essential role which is to provide our children with what no other source can give them, an identity, a sense of importance, and a sense of continuity. Whatever your situation is, it is time that is critical. Time taken up by your job or circumstances that should be devoted to children. And you know, we may not have a full-time career, but we may be so involved in volunteer work or church activities or whatever that we still don't have the time to nurture our children. And so it's time that is critical, time that should be devoted to children. Women are becoming victims of the speed of modern living. And I think that's profound. Women are becoming victims of the speed of modern living. It is dulling our feminine intuition and that marvelous closeness between us and our children that gives us a warning that they're about to come down with something. And also it helps us to pick up secret messages of misery or distress, our feminine intuition, if we're not too tired. Parents often say in times of crisis, this can't have happened. I've given my children everything. And that's the problem. We've given our children everything except ourselves. One concept that has really helped me is what Renee and I call the around the edges concept. And what this is I've begun to work at doing the things that I really enjoy and that are fulfilling to me, like practicing the violin and writing and studying. I try to do these things when the children and Bob aren't home. And then when they're home, I'm completely available to them. And you know how easy it is if you get into a project you're really enjoying that when the kids come home, you want to keep doing it and you're just not available. And I found the Lord really has honored just putting that aside when they're home and work doing it around the edges. Now, when your children are small, that's very difficult to do. But I think it can be done in smaller ways. And just remember that your lives are seasonal and they won't always be small. That's really true, even though you might not think it's true. And so we see that motherhood might be much more of an identity than we think. But, I mean, not an identity, but a vocation. Much more of a vocation than we think. But will it give us our identity? And I think the answer to that is no. Identity is something that I've been struggling with for years. And I think only in the last month have I began to understand how God wants to give me an identity. And I would like to share with you some of those answers that he's given me just in the last month. When God created Adam and Eve, he had a specific purpose in mind for them. And that purpose was that they were to be the special personal friends of the most powerful of beings. And they found their greatest joy in that relationship and in the experience of his perfect love for them. Whenever they had questions, they would go to him, and his guidance would continually open new vistas for them. And the high point of their day was in the evening when God came and walked with them in the garden. He was preeminent in their lives and gave them a sense of destiny and worth. The psalmist tells us that each one of us was created for a specific purpose, that we're unique and we have a specific purpose in the world. Psalm 139 says, "Thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst weave me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, O God, because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and my soul knows it very well. Thine eyes did see my unformed substance when as yet..." Let's see. "Thine eyes did see..." I've learned this in about three translations, and I always get it confused. Okay. "Thou didst see my unformed substance, and in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." And God wrote ahead the days that were ordained for you when you were in your mother's womb. He saw you being formed, and he weaved you for a purpose. So each of us, like a piece of a great puzzle, is unique and needed. And this has helped me a whole lot. Each of us, like a piece of a great puzzle, is unique and needed. And so therefore, we're not more important than anybody else, but we are very important. See that. Self-hatred, therefore, is a great wrong, because if we reject ourselves, then we are rejecting a person that God created with careful design and purpose. And there are beautiful and desirable things in every one of us. And what we need to do is to admit the negatives and not try to ignore the negatives, but admit them, and then relegate those to the periphery of our lives and focus on the positives. And if you focus on the negative, you will have a sense of boredom and a sense of worthlessness that will paralyze. So what we need to do is to focus on the positives. And you know, God has dealt the death blow to our greatest negative, which is moral guilt. And as we look to Christ, we see how God fulfilled his promise to Adam and Eve, his promise of redemption in their great despair, so that now who we are depends on who he is, because we are children of the King. We are daughters of the King, and he wants us to reign with him. C.S. Lewis says that the more we let him take us over, the more we truly become ourselves. Not in our natural states are we nearly so much real persons. And you can think about that a long time. I don't think that we can fathom what God did for us in Christ as far as identity is concerned. It's just tremendous. But we can be continually learning more and more about this. It was because of Adam's close relationship to God and the fact that he knew what God's will was for him each day that he was able to perform well. And today we get the cart before the horse, don't we? The woman leaves her home and goes out to find herself in her work. But if she's seeking her value in the praise of others or in the creative work that she's amassed, she will always be insecure. And she may even try to prove herself, prove her value by being a good mother. But if she does this, then she will give, but she won't give freely. And she may even come to resent her children as she sees them exhibit a sense of personhood that she does not have. And so the truth is that optimum existence comes with the realization that identity is apart from function. Identity is apart from function. It's not our role that gives us value. Now, there are sometimes at critical periods in our lives when we need to know who we are according to God's specific purpose for us. And at these times, what we do is we reflect his life through our own individuality. And we reveal who we already are by the creative and diligent and orderly use of our God-given abilities. And we just reveal who we already are. But that's not what gives us our identity. Our identity is apart from function. The only place that we will find identity is through our daily walking and talking with God and just experiencing his unconditional love. And I think it's just really special to think of and to remember that it's only God's constancy and his unconditional love that will render us invulnerable. Only his constancy and unconditional love that will render us invulnerable. And we can walk and talk with Adam, with God, just like Adam and Eve did in the garden. And we can experience his love and guidance every day. And I pray that the Lord would help us just to give us eyes to see his daily love gifts to us and ears to hear what is his will for every day. And it is in that fellowship of giving and receiving and confessing and obeying on a daily basis that we will discover who we are. As I thought about this, it just kept coming back to me that we needed to emphasize the daily as far as identity. I think it's like we have to have our identity renewed every day in our time with the Lord. And there are two things that we've got to look for in our time with the Lord. One is his love. And we can either look back to the day before and think, oh, God did this for me yesterday. Wasn't that loving of him to do that? An example of this was yesterday, you know, I was so concerned about this material and getting all the overheads made, and yet I really wanted to be available to my family and practice what I was preaching. That's not always easy. In fact, it's not easy at all. But it was so neat because the day before that, it had just been frantic. And Robin had this big creative project she was supposed to do, Marianne, that her teacher gave her. And so, of course, I had to get in on that. And, oh, it was frantic. But Friday, it just worked out that all the kids, they were either at a party or they went over to a friend's house. And it was really quiet. You know, I just thank the Lord that, you know, he just did that. It was just a love gift from him. And I thanked him for that morning. Or you may go to the Word and just find a special love promise for the day. But I think we need to experience his love daily and that he wants us to. And then we need to know what his will is for us that day. And what this takes is waiting before the Lord. Okay, God, what's the most important thing that I do today? What do you want me to do? And as you receive that answer, you know, if you don't get anything else done, if you've done that, then you know who you are. And you have a sense of destiny and worth. And I'd like to recommend a book. It's called Closer Than a Brother. I think probably Nancy has read that. I know Bob's the one that recommended it a long time ago to us. But what it is, have any of you read that? Okay. It's a David Winter. It's a reinterpretation of the practice of the presence of God, and it's put in modern language. And I think that every woman should take that, and we probably need to read it once a month. Now, meditate on those chapters and get some of those principles into our lives. Brother Lawrence talks about how he says, in the depths of my being, I keep myself shut away with God, even when I'm knee-deep in vegetables. And then another thing I've been doing recently that's really meaningful is to read the Song of Solomon and to read it thinking of Christ as the bridegroom and me as the bride. And that's just a really special love letter. That's a neat thing to do. So two things on a daily basis, his love, his guidance, and this will give us our identity in him. Okay, now last we're going to talk about deeds, being adorned with good works. It's so easy for us to major on the negatives and to think about what we can't do as women. But what we need to do is to concentrate on the possibilities of service that are within our realm. The needs are really great, and the use of our creative gifts is really invaluable. What we're going to do is to study, do a little study. I couldn't do an exhaustive study for you of Proverbs 31 because it's just unbelievably deep. And the more I study it, the more I find. But you might want to turn to Proverbs 31 so you can kind of be looking at these passages. Verses Proverbs 31, verse 10 through 31. And then also we're going to be looking at Titus 2 and then some passages in 1 Timothy. I think it is very significant that at the end of Proverbs, the Book of Wisdom, there are 22 verses on the home life of a godly woman. And it was like God was trying to impress indelibly upon the hearts of his people that a woman's home life will make all the difference in our nation. And the King James says that this woman is a virtuous woman, but a better translation of that word is that she is a force of means and resource, an army of wealth and ability. And the foundation of her life is the fear of the Lord. And because she has her identity firm in the Lord, she is productive. To be productive means to yield results, profits, and benefits. Source. An army of wealth and ability. And the foundation of her life is the fear of the Lord. And because she has her identity firm in the Lord, she is productive. To be productive means to yield results, profits, and benefits. To yield results, profits, and benefits. Now, as you go about halfway down in the passage, you'll see that it says, she senses that her gain is good. And it is imperative that we sense that our gain is good if we're going to be able to continue with our work. This woman has a very special skill. She's a seamstress, and she knows how to do all kinds of things with a needle. It tells us that she decorates her home using this skill. When it says she makes coverings for herself, that word is actually tapestries. So she is decorating her home with her skill. She makes clothes for her family. She makes beautiful clothes for herself. She's just really beautiful. And she makes clothes for the needy. She even sells her wares for profit. Our pastor once had a church member come up to him, and she said, "Pastor, I am so frustrated because I cannot get into real estate. I have tried and tried, and I just can't get into it." Well, Pastor Tucker thought for a minute, and he said, well, he just couldn't figure out why she felt like she had to get into real estate. And she shared with him that she felt that since the Proverbs 31 woman bought and sold land, that she had to get into real estate if she was to be godly. Well, just as that isn't true, see, Proverbs is a book of principles. And I don't think that every woman has to be a seamstress either. Remember that she works with her hands in delight. And there are a lot of us, including me, who feel that sewing is anything but a delight. But what you can do is think, now, what are my gifts? What am I good at in the home? You know, you may be really good at cooking. You may be a French chef or something. Or you may really know how to garden or to decorate your home. You may be an artist like Jackie. She is back there. And, you know, paint and do all kinds of neat things with your being an artist. You may be good at music or at writing. And I think what we need to do is to think how we can use these things in our home and be more productive. Edith Schaefer tells about a family who had an economic need. And the woman didn't go out to get a job to meet that need. But instead, they tried to think of what they could do in their home. And so they started a candle-making business in their basement. I really think that if there is an economic need, we need to think of things we can do in our home. I have a friend who took some toll painting courses, and she got her husband to cut out scraps of wood in all different shapes, and she would paint carrots and onions and daisies and apples on these scraps of wood, and she would sell them for an almost total profit. She made a lot of money that way. I have another friend who feels her gift is reading. And so what she does is she reads books for the Christian bookstore and then gives them her evaluation, and they pay her for those services. And I find that when I encourage my family in music, and when we have little family concerts and I help them work up things, and we have family concerts, invite the neighbors in, or when I play the piano for my husband when he's tired, or when I teach piano when there is an economic need, that this tremendously enriches our whole family and home life. So I don't know, I just use your creativity. I think you can think of all kinds of ways you can use your gifts in your home, and then you will still be available to your children. But don't be like a lady that I saw in the clothing, the mill outlet the other day. I do buy materials sometimes. I was going to make some pillows. When I have to, I do. But this one lady, she was really young, and she was really pretty, had two little children with her, and she just had yards and yards and yards and yards of ribbon lying out there on the counter, you know, and all kinds of material. And I just, you know, I looked at her and I said, "Boy, you're really going to do some sewing, aren't you?" She said, "Well, I do this. I give these to the stores, and they sell them." And I said, "Well, that's really neat, you know, because you can do that in your home and still take care of your children." She said, "Well, it's really not, because I sew about 12 to 14 hours a day, and I'm thinking about hiring a babysitter." So don't do that. I'm not sure that's what God would have. As we look at this woman, as you've read it, I'm sure you thought, man, I could never do all she does. She is just a whirlwind of activity. She's adorned with good works. But as you look closer, you'll discover that there's a delicate balance of priorities. Her first priority is the Lord, and that's the foundation for her whole life. Her second priority is her husband, And there are five verses in this passage, in the 22 verses, that has to do with her relationship to her husband. Five verses. And her third priority is her children, according to the allocation of verses in the passage. Women throughout the Bible are commended for bearing children. And when it says bearing children, it actually means also training. It's not just the physical bearing, but also the training. And women are commended for that. She looks well to the ways of her household. And this means that she leans forward and she peers into the distance, discerning the consequence of the mode of behavior of her children and looking at their character. And she doesn't eat the bread of idleness. She takes action on what she sees. And I believe that she guards the intellectual atmosphere of her home and what goes into her children's minds. And character building is one of her greatest priorities. I have a son who has two interests, a 14-year-old son. And one of them is skiing, and one of them is war. Now, he has another interest. It's girls, but we won't count that one for this talk anyway. But I go to the library, and I pray over books that have to do with his interest, but yet really have something to say. And it was a real victory for me last, and for the Lord, I feel, last summer when he picked up The Red Badge of Courage and read it and said he liked it. The last couple of months, my 9-year-old girl and I have been closeting ourselves in her room and doing secret projects for Christmas. And when we do this, we have all kinds of fun talking, and I find out where she is in her thinking. The next priority after the children of the godly woman is she's purchaser for her household. And in our terms, she would have spent a whole day purchasing things for her household every week. She would go around looking for bargains. Now, she wouldn't just buy the first thing she saw, but she would try to use the money really wisely. She would invest in things and get raw materials for her productivity. And I know that I'm convicted that I need to spend more time doing this and using our money really wisely, investing it. There's one verse in this passage, only one, that could have to do with housework. And this, it talks about organizing and being efficient. And herein, balance is key, balance. You know, we can do so little around our house that people just hate to come to our house, and our kids and our husband don't enjoy it. Or we can do so much that we just give our lives to a house. You know, and does God mean for us to give our lives to a house? He really doesn't. So I'd just like to give you about three or four ideas that have helped me in this area. One is try different methods of organization. Now, if you try one plan, it doesn't work for you, well, just try another one. And keep trying until you find something that will work. I have certain days for everything, and I'll just share those with you. Maybe it'll give you some ideas. Monday is shopping day. Tuesday is catch-up and baking day. Sometimes I bake bread and try to catch up on things I'm behind on. Wednesday is the day I spend with Bob because that's his day off. Thursday is housework and washing day. Now, you may think, I could never do that. Well, I didn't think I could either. I'm messy. Nancy Sheffield's the one that gave me that idea. And I thought, I could never do that. But I tried it, and I really liked it. You know, I'll just go ahead and go up into the evening if I have to get all the washing and the ironing done, and see, it frees up the rest of the week. It's really work. You know, get over the hump that one day. So I like that. And Friday is study day. I do my Bible study and any extra reading. And so many women don't develop their minds. Be sure to set time aside for study. Saturday is closet and drawer day, and Sunday is worship and rest. But just try different things till you come up with something that will work for you. Get your children to work with you as a team. And you know how working as a team is so much more fun. You know, train them to do different chores, and as they get older, give them more, and that will help. Another idea is to figure out what it is that makes you and your husband feel really good about the house. For instance, we like things to be picked up, and we don't like clutter in the house, and we don't like dirty floors. And so I try to get those things done every morning before I do anything else, and then we feel really good about the house, even though other things might not be done. And then get the menial work done as fast as you can. Just work at it fast and get those dishes done really fast so you can press on to more important things. So those are just some ideas that might help you. Again, as you look at this woman, you think, man, I could never do all she does. But there's a verse in there that says she girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. So what she does is she takes out time for renewal and strengthening. What is it that gives you a sense of perspective and renewal? It would have to include time with the Lord regularly, and it would include probably sometimes a whole day away from the house with the Lord in the Word and prayer, just to get perspective. For some people, it might mean a regular nap. I take a nap every day. It might be an hour of music or a day of skiing, but whatever it is, make sure that you don't leave that out of your schedule because you need it for strengthening and for renewal. This woman's last priority is her ministry. She stretches out her hand to the needy. She extends her hand to the poor. And this is an overflow of her life. It's not the main thrust of her life because her family comes first.
And one of the men said, well, women are more emotional. And this girl in the back said, we are not. She didn't even realize that she said it until everybody just cracked up laughing. She really meant it. So this study is based on the belief that the biology of a woman really says something. It gives us huge clues about who she is in essence. Now, when I started thinking about how to write this up, I was alone in the library one night. It was after dark. And I was just sitting in a corner, and I was thinking and thinking. I said, Lord, give me an analogy. And this came. Imagine that we took a bird. Say the Lord did create this bird. And he structured it so that it had a very delicate wingspan, delicate bone structure. It's made to do certain things. Now let's say we could look at its mind, its brain. Let's open up the bird's head and we'd look in there. And let's imagine that God sent a set of instructions into the bird's head that were very different from its anatomy. Okay? And then just close the head back up. In other words, the bird is going to be different in essence than it is in anatomy. Okay? So then let's take this bird. Now, maybe God didn't put those instructions there. Maybe bird society put them there in his head. But let's take this bird and let's tell this bird that you were made to drag dead cats up a hill. And so the bird says, okay, I'll drag dead cats up a hill. So he starts pulling with his beak on this end of the cat, and a tremendous, you know, sweat and splutter and all that happen. And then the bird goes around behind the dead cat and nudges it with its head. And it works and it works and it works until the dead cat gets at the top of the hill. And at the top of the hill, there's a bunch of birds from Bird Society up there. And they all go, yay, and they applaud the bird. Okay, so the bird, the bird is totally exhausted. Just no oomph left. But he hears all this applause and he thinks, wow, this is really something. And the bird will turn around and do what? Go back and do the same thing again. Not because it feels good. Not because there's any internal sense of rightness or oughtness about the thing, but because of the loudness of the applause. Now, I maintain that that is where we find the modern woman. She is doing things outside of her sphere, and as a result, she's the extra energy taken and the tension taken. It frustrates her over the moon. It leaves her exhausted. It leaves her torn apart inside about who she is. She's at schism with herself. She's schizophrenic with herself, in a sense. But because the culture says, this is marvelous that you do these things, she does it again and again and again. So, what does the body then say about who we are? Well, because of my career, I've done some extensive study in the area of the brain. And I want to relate to you today what I've discovered and what I think it says about men and women. The brain, I haven't studied it surgically or anything like that, but I've studied it in terms of conceptual development. The brain, we know, is divided into two hemispheres, and those hemispheres think differently. The right brain and the left brain. The way I remember them is the left brain starts with L, and so L is the first letter of the word logic. So that's the side that's the logical side, the symboling side. The right brain is the creative side, the intuitive side, the spatial side, the imaginative side. Okay? So there's two distinct hemispheres in the brain. Also, we know that one half of the brain is dominant. And the third thing we know about the brain is that it is put in a position of switched, it's in a switched location. In other words, the right side of the brain controls the right side of the body. The left side of the brain controls, what did I just say? The right side of the brain controls the left side of the body. Left side of the brain controls the right side of the body. Now, was God asleep when he set the brain in man? Did he wake up half groggy that morning and say, well, I know it fits in there someplace, and switch the hemispheres? Now, it would take just the same space to put those things. This side takes care of this side, this side takes care of this side. And as far as we know, there's no scientific reason why those two things should be switched. So, what do you think that says? Well, I think that the Lord in his infinite wisdom knew that we would reach the 20th century and be into anatomical studies and open that thing up and discover if those two things are switched. And as we study, like Newton said, we study the words of God and the works of God, and that those two things are tremendously integrated. I think it tells us that there is a principle of mutual exchange in the universe. In other words, it says in Scripture that we are to think about the kingdom of heaven. And we think so much about the kingdom of heaven that he will think about us. Consider the lilies of the field. They don't even toil or spin. So seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and he will take care of you. Now, I think that's also true in marriage. If the husband, ideally, were thinking about the woman's needs, her whims, everything, if he were taking care of that, her needs would be met. And conversely, if the woman were taking care of the husband's needs, his needs would be met. Beautiful principle in the universe. The principle of mutual exchange, mutual caring. And the fact that we find that embedded in our own anatomy is profound to me. It's beautiful to me. That truth is in our own bodies. Okay, the second thing, that the brain is dominant on one side. Now, watch this. Let's say I'll take a book here. And I don't have a dominant side. Let's imagine I don't have a dominant side of my brain. I go for that book. The fact that I have a dominant side relegates, it puts order in the universe. I know that most things I'm going to pick up with this dominant side. I don't have to have a federal case to decide it. So it makes beauty in the universe. It makes order in the universe. Now, if I need the other side, now the book I can just pick up with my right hand, but suppose I go to pick up the birdcage. I've got one hand to lift, the other hand to support, to come to the aid of, to pick up the cadence of. Okay, so I think the principle that what we see in the brain is the fact that dominance and aiding are God's rule. They're his principle in the universe. Okay, the third thing about the brain is that it thinks differently. Now, they have done studies of cutting the hemispheres between the two brains, cutting the brain between the two hemispheres. Now, just take that cord. It's a thick cord. It looks kind of like a big, thick muscle. It is a big, thick muscle. They cut it, and they've done it in epileptics, and they've discovered that the epilepsy disappears. But guess what else happens? They do bizarre things, like they could put a square thing in a square hole, square peg in a square hole, and you'd ask them what that is, and they'd say it's an apple. In other words, there's no transfer of information between the two hemispheres. So work is done bizarrely. Things aren't completed. Things don't make sense. So I think what that shows is that God has made the man and the woman as dual perceivers of all of reality. The man thinks one way, the woman thinks another way. And you must have the input from both to give a full-orbed picture of what life's about. You know, you've heard of stories where the pastor's wife, she'll pick up, she'll say, honey, somehow you're not getting through to the congregation. And maybe it's the way you're wearing your tie. Or maybe it's your idiosyncrasies or whatever. The woman brings to the man perceptions that he can't pick up. She might be have her feelers out emotionally in a way that he doesn't. On the other hand, she might be so concerned about Johnny's knee being scraped that she misses the big picture that we have to get someplace or whatever. So dual perceivers in the brain. Now, this is what's beautiful. As you get the information from both hemispheres, it comes out through one mouth. It is physically impossible for me to speak two differing things out of my mouth at the same time. I cannot speak one thing out of this side, one thing out of this side. There is a unity about what comes through my mouth. Again, the dual perceivers and the headship of the man. Once both of the input is given from both sides, the man goes ahead and makes the decision and leads. And sometimes those things are so very, very close, you can't say at what point the man took over leadership. And that's, of course, the beauty of a marriage. So, those are the three things we get from the brain. The principle of dominance, the principle of dual perceivers and one voice, and the principle of mutual exchange or mutual caring. Second part of the body. I began to wonder about the structure. And I went to Bob Ridley, because he is a doctor, and I asked him about some of these things. Let's take the bones first. Do you know that a man's bones, well, first of all, we can just see visually, a man's skeletal structure is different from a woman's. It is larger, by and large. In fact, so much so, the woman has a much more delicate skeleton, even if she's a larger woman. You can take a single bone and tell from history, if you just discover the bone, and tell if it was a woman or a man. They can do that from the single bone because they know, okay, chart it out, that would be what kind of a skeleton. The second thing about the bones is that man's bones are more dense in terms of the calcium content than a woman's bones. They are less opaque. They are denser. The calcium content in a man's bones are denser than a woman's. Now, strength. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. Muscle structure. A man's muscles are more bulky and fibrous than a woman's. And you can tell that when they flex their muscle, it bunches up. When a woman flexes it, it's smooth and sleek. There's a difference in the way they're made. Now, Bob was telling me about this woman who had taken on a job in a heavy, rather heavy factory job, and she was coming repeatedly about some muscle fatigue and muscle knotting and all that kind of stuff. And when they go to calculate whether she needs disability compensation or whatever, I wonder if they will consider that the disability might be merely that she's a woman. Novel idea, isn't that? Okay. Another thing, the voice of a man and a woman. A man's, you think it's a seemingly small thing, well it is, but to a little boy in puberty, it's a very consuming thing. He realizes that his voice is changing. The vocal cords lengthen and relax, and so he picks up the lower end of the spectrum of sound. A woman's voice is higher. Now, a woman's voice, compared to a little girl's voice, would resonate more. But it doesn't change in terms of the length and the relaxation to the degree that a man's voice does. Now, when you take a beautiful choir and you hear the men's voices, it's usually they have the bass, the supportive bom, 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 you know, those parts. And the woman's voice comes in on the top and often carries the melody. It's the intricate, it would add the beauty to the thing. Now, can you imagine us going to Washington, D.C. and lobbying against such differences? The beauty of those things together. God in his diversity, in his variety, in dealing with human beings is just unfathomable. Okay, now what about hair? Why hair? What was in God's mind? Hair doesn't help us eat or lift things any better or carry oxygen to any part of the body. It is, in fact, dead when it leaves the head. So is it a thing without meaning? I think not. The scriptures tell us that even in this small area that it has meaning. The scriptures tell us that a woman's hair, a woman is a glory and she has a glory. And her hair is her glory. You think, my hair? But it is. A woman has a glory and she is a glory. Her hair is her glory. Her hair was also given to her as a covering, a symbol of submission. It is a natural covering, a daily natural covering, a symbol of submission. Now, I want to share with you something that I've picked up in the fashion world. When I went through some big department stores in Denver last year, I noticed that the models, the plastic models or whatever they're made out of, were bald. And maybe you've seen that in magazines and stores. They're bald. Now, the body part will be like metallic silver or gold or whatever. This very streamlined look, and the hip will be jutting out, and they'll be bald. Now, I think there is a reason. I don't think the advertisers know what the reason is. They know that to not put hair on the head of a woman is very cocky. It's very independent. It's very freeing. They're making a statement by it. Now, they don't know why no hair makes that statement. All they know is they like the look. They know it gets across that impression. Well, the reason it does is because God set it up that way. But they don't know it. You know, many women are enrolling in military academies now. And do you know that when the men go to the military academies, you all know this, they shave their head. Well, do you know what? They don't shave a woman's head. Why? What's the difference? There is an innate knowledge that you don't shave a woman's hair. They don't know where that innate knowledge came from. They just act on the basis of it. It's because God put it there. Now, when I was in India last summer, I saw women who had grown their hair, you know, their whole life, and they would worship these foreign gods and these idols, and they would cut the hair off. They would just shave it completely, and they would take this long length of hair and go and lay it in front of the gods. Now, why do that? Why not cut your fingernails or something else? I mean, why? Because they have an innate sense that giving your hair is giving your glory. It is the ultimate in humility. And we see that in a reverential sense. We see that in the scriptures with Mary. She went to the Lord and she wiped his feet with her tears and her hair. Do you know why? It was the supreme moment of worship. And before God, no glory struts. And she was so prostrate before him. She wanted to laud him and honor him and lift him up so badly. She thought, everything has to go. And what, you know, what's left? And finally she grabbed her hair. I'll wipe his feet. Now, I don't think she knew what she was doing. But God did. And God records that in the scriptures. She took her glory. No glory shall be exalted before him. She took it and put it down. Now, another place in the scripture, we see in Numbers 5:18 that a woman was to take, you don't have to look that up, a woman, if she was thought to be caught in adultery, she was brought before the priest, and they would make her swallow the water of bitterness. And if it turned bitter, that was God's sign that she had been involved in adultery. If the water remained sweet, then she was pure. But before she took this water of bitterness, I think God's hints through Scripture are so significant. They said, take down your hair. So she goes and she stands in front of the priest and undoes it and it drapes down. Before she takes... Now, why did they, at a moment like this, when they're talking about adultery, why did they say that? Is that like saying, go take your sweater off? I think it was a symbol that before this judgment comes, you will show the priest and your husband, the husband was there as well, that you are under their authority, that your hair will show that you're under, letting it down will show that you're under authority. Otherwise, why does the Bible record it? I think when you add these things up, you log them together, they really show a picture. Okay, the next thing in the anatomy, and the last thing. I call it the heart of the matter. It's really about sex. The most obvious difference between men and women can be seen, of course, in the sex organs themselves. The breath and the womb of the woman are both, they both speak of providing for someone else. Now, be it the babe or the man, both of those organs are used for both of those kinds of individuals. They are organs of rejoicing. They're organs of renewal. They're organs of nourishment. Solomon says in the Song of Songs, "My breasts are like towers, thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment." And then it says in Proverbs 5:19, "Rejoice in the wife of your youth, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love." Ezekiel's wife was referred to as the desire of his eyes and the delight of his soul. The physical led to his soul being delighted, being deeply satisfied. Now, the proportion of the woman's body that is given over to these organs, these supportive organs, is considerably more than the proportion of the man's body. So I think that's a large hint about who we are in essence. The proportion, the statement that makes about who we are in essence. The man's world is largely one of dominion, career, and decision. The woman's of sustaining and encouraging personhood in all who are touched by her. She has the joy of helping build character and working on self-images. And she gifts the man with stability and encouragement, endorsement and adoration, and without which many men crumble. You know, you've heard of stories where the men's wives die and they just fall apart, or if a woman abandons a man. It's because that tremendous resource is gone. Now, the way in which the sex organs function themselves shows too that man is initiator and a woman is a receiver. Now, even down to minutia, take the egg. The egg lies demure, just resting, and the sperm initiates. In fact, I've seen little microscopic pictures of this. The sperm comes to the egg and just attacks until it can attach itself. There's tremendous aggression, even in the egg and the sperm. And so I think that reveals to us a lot about who we are in essence. So consider the men in our culture, how often dwarfed their capacity is because women have left their role, how aimless they feel and how at sea and how adrift. And then consider the women in the world who would seek career even at the expense of relationships, women who would enter into competition with the very one who would die for her if she had not left her role. How crazy it all is, the world in which we live. Both of them miserable and not knowing why.